Hey everyone, welcome back to Better, Faster, Further, podcast number 5. It's gone by quick. I can't believe we're at 5 already, Adam.
Amazing, isn't it?
It really is. This is Regan Bach, managing partner and co-founder of Better, Faster, Further. I am sitting in Marin County, California. I have my colleague, Adam Ogoski. Adam, how are you?
I'm doing great, Regs. Thanks for asking.
Where are you?
I am still tucked away in Salida, Colorado, nestled up against the mountains. Hopefully going to get some more snow tonight.
Yeah, we're expecting some rain our way, and hopefully that means lots of snow for Colorado. I will never complain about rain anymore. and I know you guys can use the snow, so let's definitely embrace that.
100%.
We are stoked today to have our good friend, who Adam and I have both known for a very long time, and colleague Chad Crabtree joining us for the podcast. He's gracious enough to take some time out of his busy schedule. Chad, how are you, buddy?
So good to see you, Regan and Adam. Nice to be here with you today.
We're stoked to have you. Thank you so much. And where are you physically right now?
So I'm in Central Mountains of Colorado. Similar to Adam, I'm just on the other side of the divide. So I'm sitting in Crested Butte, Colorado.
That's awesome. For lots of folks, I think they've heard of Crested Butte ski area, at least, and small town tucked away in the Rocky Mountains, but another gem. We're lucky to live in the places that we do. It's awesome. I have known Chad personally for a very long time. He is good friends with my younger brother, Jamie, and that has blossomed into him becoming a good friend of mine over the years. And we all grew up in Durango, Colorado together, and have been on many an adventure. We were all very deep in the kayaking world, both competing in freestyle events and running hard rapids and doing river trips and dropping waterfalls and stuff. We have lots of stories, but that is definitely kind of the backdrop and network of a lot of the time that we have spent together. And then our families over the years have also morphed into being pretty close as well. So, Chad, I think nobody can introduce you better than yourself, but thrilled to have you here. I'm wondering if you would just open it up and maybe start at the beginning and tell us about just like you, a little bit of your background, and then we'll kind of dive into some of your professional arc and get everybody caught up to where we are today. But give us a little bit of your just personal background.
Yeah, good stuff. So I live in Crested Butte now, small town, close to the rivers, streams, mountains, full effective all four seasons. That was a change in a transition just recently for my family. But I grew up in a different small mountain town in the southwest corner of the state. So Regan, as you mentioned, born and raised in Durango. I was a child and a product of the 80s. Was so fortunate to grow up learning to love the outdoors and spending all my free time on the river, in the hills, on skis, whatever that looked like. And just how important that is as a young kid growing up. My mom and dad were both hardworking middle class. My mom was a ski patroller and a ER nurse for 30 years at the local hospital there. My dad was in construction, owned a concrete business, and then worked in various construction opportunities and a little bit of finance towards the end of his career. So all growing up, I really saw hardworking parents that did everything they could to give us the opportunity to see that, see work ethic, but also how to enjoy just living and being outside. So I always knew that I wanted to work hard, and being around my dad and building things, I was always really intrigued with the art of building things or constructing things in big infrastructure. So throughout my high school years, I was always either working with my hands, taking welding classes, or learning to do ceramics. I know there's a lot of arts in your family too, going through Durango High School program, but learning all about that. And meanwhile, kayaking and competing in ski racing, Nordic ski racing.
Totally.
But it ultimately ended up putting me in a place where I knew I wanted to go to college. And I did a year at Fort Lewis and traveled and did a lot of kayaking. I met my my future wife at that time, landed ultimately in Colorado, or Colorado School of Mines in Golden, Colorado, and did a structural engineering degree. I graduated with a structural degree. I didn't know anything other than structural engineering, really coming out of that school. I really wanted to work on big infrastructure. So I thought, I took an internship my last year, and I was so pumped to go work for a small consulting firm in structural engineering. As I'm graduating, I take a month off and I go travel and we go surfing. And I come back and I didn't have a job. And they said, "Hey, Chad, our structural department, we decided to close it down, but we have a whole civil department." And I said, what's that? And they said, "Well, we're happy to have you shift over and take a job in civil engineering. Or we can give you a referral. There's a bunch of other structurals that might be hiring." I was willing to check it out. And for those who don't know, civil engineering is all the other stuff, infrastructure related, that doesn't fall into the structural category. And so it could be related to building airports or home construction, or a lot of environmental aspects go into civil. And so I embarked on that. It was a great experience for a handful of years. I got my first opportunity to work on a wind farm. And that was 2009, as kind of the economy was going through a major shift. And fast forward to now, I've spent the last nearly the last 15 years working on utility scale renewable energy projects with an engineering background, with a business background. I went back for some more school. And now we're landed in Crested Butte. I travel a fair bit. When I'm not traveling, I'm working in my home office and being outside as much as I can.
That's awesome, man. I love it. When you were talking about just your upbringing and your parents and kind of the family deal, it just was like, you could hit pause and replace almost anybody that we grew up with that kind of like the same narrative, right? Which is hardworking parents. You know, we didn't grow up with much money, but you know, we spent it doing cool stuff. Like I didn't know how much a lot of money was. You know, some people have more than you do, you know, some people have less, right? But you're just there doing it. But garage full of toys and camping equipment, and you know, a good time is, you know, getting new skis at the ski swap and hitting the hills. I remember you pretty heavy into cross country, into the cross country skiing. Were you a runner as well, or was it just the skiing?
Yeah, the running was a way to train in the off season, right? And I always thought I wanted to downhill race, like alpine race. And my parents were like, "Look, that's like five pairs of $1,000 skis, and you got to have a ski pass. And then every time you go to a race, you got to buy a lift ticket." And they're like, "It's cost prohibitive. But hey, there's this other kind of skiing. It's a little bit like my story in engineering." They're like, you can't do structural engineering, or you can't do downhill racing, but check out Nordic racing. It's a little bit cheaper. I don't know that it is in the end, but that's ultimately how I started Nordic racing. And always was sort of drawn to the long distance and endurance type of individual sports. And so I ended up ski racing all through high school.
Yeah, I remember that. I just seeing you guys out there training, and you know, at the time it was you guys doing the, you know, those long blades, like I forget what you call them, the roller blades, the ski skates or whatever. But out there training, and it's funny, your parents are like, I love you, but not that much, right? You need a cheaper sport. Cheaper hobby. That's awesome. The other thing I remember of just, you know, growing up was you always being super hands-on and just like utilitarian, welding racks for all of our trucks. I think Jamie may even still have a rack you welded. Maybe he welded that one, but I love that too. Just with a dad, you know, who's a general contractor growing up, like the joy of building stuff and stepping back and being like, I did that, and just working with your hands. There's definitely a not only a work ethic, but I think like a mindset that's attributed with just like figuring shit out, right? Like you might not know how to do it, but you know that some hard work and some study and some perseverance is going to kind of get you through that. But I hear that's a kind of a common thread with a lot of the people that we continue to hang out with. So,
yeah, for sure.
Well, that's great. So then you go to the School of Mines for folks like in Colorado. I think people know that school, and we don't have to do a deep dive on this, but you know, that's a hardcore engineering school. It's not very big, but I think it pumps out just like badass engineers. So, you know, A, where is it? What's it focused on? And then maybe you can take us from there to kind of the current state, which is some of the professional arc, and maybe start to weave in some of your narrative around just the experiences that you've had as a worker, as a manager, getting promoted, you know, whatever that kind of story is. I'd love to kind of, you know, get into it.
So at least when you're going to college at the time that I was, 2003, Colorado School of Mines was not the place to go if you were looking to like hang out and party and have like maybe what a normal college experience is for a lot of people. I think at the time, it was like a 1-to-9 ratio of women to men. Now they are way more diverse than they were back then, but it's a heads down study your buns off type of school, focused on engineering, everything from electrical engineering, metals and sciences, to aerospace, geotechnical, all of it.
Yep.
It's a state school, fairly small, and it sits nestled in Golden, Colorado. So it's just west of Denver. And fun fact, Golden was the first capital of Colorado. So I did my 4 years there. It was grueling and hard from start to finish. Enjoyed the education and enjoyed the experience tremendously. In fact, I had signed up to do a master's program right off of an undergrad. There was something in my gut that told me, like, I don't know if I want to do a master's in structural engineering. I just wasn't quite sure. So I decided to defer, not do the master's degree, get out of school. I took that first job with the consultant. I worked for, 6 years, 7 years, always sort of had the idea of going back and getting a master's, but now I had a bunch of experience. I went and got licensed as a professional engineer, which was a huge goal of mine to achieve. And, I wanted to kind of change directions and go the business route. So I went back to that school, which has a technical MBA. It's a master's of science, but it's in engineering and technology management. So I did that while I was working for a privately held multinational company that was focused on building utility scale wind, solar, and storage projects all over the world. That 10-year period of my life is kind of a blur. It's like, I wouldn't change it, but a lot of work in an industry that has been on a meteoric rise, really growing up from kind of an R&D emerging market to what I would consider now a pretty well established and working towards being a mature market, if it's not already in some's eyes. So really, really interesting, fun market to be in. Working full time, going to school, having a couple kids and raising a family. And trying to get in and that was that period. I learned so much. I spent a lot of time in the field, helping to build big projects. I mean, we're talking about like, if you're going to go drive through the Midwest and you see the big wind turbines spinning, hundreds and hundreds of turbines, spin in the Midwest, those were the size projects that I was working on. And today you see, you know, maybe fields and fields of solar panels. So very, very, very large infrastructure projects, really focused on, mega goals of decarbonization.
Totally.
So I don't practice engineering today per se. I still use a lot of the education from the undergrad and the engineering world, but a lot of business and management and leadership work as I work for a company today called Ultegg Engineers. We're about 900 engineers, project management professionals, focused on kind of what we call four lifeline sectors or four markets. We serve the main fabric of infrastructure in our daily lives. We focus on water, transportation, power, and renewable projects. And I lead the renewables market there.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was doing just some research, and it sounds like, you know, Ooltag has been like in existence since 1944. And it's kind of like one of these, you know, at least from an outside perspective, you know, you guys are central in so many things. Obviously, you call it kind of the lifeline sectors, but since 1944 and really just doing tons and tons of big projects. I think it said somewhere that, you know, any given moment, you guys have like 1,800 projects a year going on.
Yeah, small projects, gigantic projects across all those markets. It's the heritage of being in business 80 years is pretty phenomenal. And really like started out working for, you know, when we say power, we're talking about like, you know, the power lines or the big transmission lines that you see outside your door or see along the highway. And, you know, they support a grid that today looks like a very centralized energy or power market, where you got big power plants, whether they're, you know, might be a coal plant, might be a hydro plant, you know, in today's day and age, it might be a wind or solar plant, but they're big centralized plants. And then they feed out along big transmission lines or the big wires. And as you get into smaller communities, then it steps down to a smaller wire. And then eventually it's going to your home or into your business. And that's the heritage of Ooltag, is working for those customers. And in the last 20 years, you know, we've seen such a shift towards lowering our carbon footprint that I've been really fortunate to play a part in growing the renewables business for that company, but also for our clients.
Chad, how long have you been at Ooltag? I forget. Did you say that already?
3 years.
3 years. And did you start heading up the renewables sector?
No, it was established probably in the early 2000s. Just started to work for a handful of existing power utility clients in the upper Midwest that needed to lean on a trusted, known hand in a consultant like Ooltag to build their first wind farm. You know, they had a lot of other maybe fossil generating assets in their fleet, and they went to go build their first wind farm and didn't know much about it. And they asked the Ooltag team 20 years ago, have you ever worked on a wind farm? And that the team said, no, but we can figure it out. We're engineers. We'll find a way. And that's sort of the short version of how Ooltag landed in the renewables business. And so fast forward to today, it makes up probably about 40% of our total work that we perform in a given year. And we're not just in the Midwest anymore. I mean, we've kind of expanded coast to coast. Just last year, we acquired a company up in Ontario that is niche around systems integration and SCADA and automation type of work. So privately held company, it's 100% employee owned, so we're all shareholders, and pretty exciting time to be growing, but growing sustainably and at kind of the rate and the pace that we want to.
Oh, that's cool. So when you started it at Ooltag, what was sort of like you mentioned you were no longer, you know, hands-on engineer. So what was your first sort of initiative that you took on there? What was, where'd you get going?
Yeah. So I got brought in as the market director. And the first thing I told the hiring, C-suite member at the time was, you've read my resume and you know, I come from a construction and an engineering background. I'm not your classic salesperson. And she's like, you're exactly what we need to do that role. It's been a huge challenge for me. It's been really, really fun. I'm not a classically trained salesperson, but have always learned through many mentors in the professional space. And some not in the professional space, that like, we're all salespeople. We're all we're all promoting at some way, shape, or form, right? And especially in a company where you're growing, you're small and nimble, and often are wearing many hats. Like we all have a duty to represent the positive in what we do and what the team can bring. So for me, it was about building a team. You know, the Renewables Group was growing rapidly, and we had so many smart teammates that come from really strong power background. But we knew that the projections and the trajectory of the U.S. and Canadian renewables market was coming at a pace faster than you know, normal hiring practice and normal just growing and nurturing a team was going to allow for. And really, I mean, this is all just to be able to accommodate and support our clients that were coming to us. This wasn't with having to do a whole lot of additional business development efforts. So a lot of just master planning, kind of building up a strategy, and then major focus on finding and building the right team, building a high performing team that comes with a diverse set of backgrounds and diverse way of thinking. Really focus on not bringing in all the same type of thinkers.
Yeah. Diversity, key. Diversity in thought. Absolutely. That had to be a little bit scary to come in as a market director for this company and take on the task of building out the renewables team. And, you know, as you mentioned, not being a classically trained salesperson, it sounded like there was enough business coming your way, but you had to manage it and support it and execute. What was the biggest challenge? Where did you spend the most amount of your internal resources on at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I was so fortunate that the a lot of the bones was already there. Like, okay, I didn't have to build the renewables from the ground up. It was really a matter of taking it to the next level and expanding. And I think, I mean, even just since my short time of being there, our renewables team has had the fortune of growing to nearly 3x. So it's been a lot of growth. And I think our biggest challenge, maybe outside of like, I got hired maybe a handful of months or before COVID. So I didn't get a chance to get out and see as many clients and meet as many of the teammates in person as I would have liked to in those initial stages. But maybe putting that aside, I think the biggest challenge, and really continues to be the biggest challenge for us, is labor, you know, and is finding and bringing up talent who wants to be a part of this market. Like, there's a lot of energy and passion around the work that we do. There's not enough of it for the growth in the market, right? I mean, if you were to look at like graduation rate of college, it's a third of where the market projections are just for the renewables market. And you need people in healthcare, and you need people in finance, and you need people in construction industries, and you need people in all these other sectors. And it's like, we're one sector. I mean, luckily it's a pretty fun place to be. There's a lot of social acceptance and excitement around, you know, these lofty decarbonization goals. So I feel like the market has maybe an advantage to attracting talent, but it's really tough. And at the same time, like, you guys know better than I do, like, a lot of your clients and maybe listeners work in the tech space. Like, we are welcoming tech and innovation into our world because we see this as like, we've got to do our work smarter and faster and more automated if we're going to achieve what we're trying to achieve at a macro scale.
I think that's one of the cool things Adam and I were chatting about before we started the podcast, was just like, we find so much value in the cross-pollination of verticals, right? Like, lessons learned in one can be directly applied in others. you know, big companies informing startups, startups informing big companies, universities informing other sectors, whatever it is. And so I love what you just said. And I think it's really cool. I mean, at least in the tech sector recently, there's been lots of layoffs. I mean, you know, people cutting 5 to 15% of their workforce. And there's a lot of extremely talented engineering-esque people out there. And I'm super excited about what the future holds in the next 2 to 3 years. I think a lot of those people are going to band together and come up with the next iteration of the cool shit, if you will. But right now it's interesting because there's kind of a surge of talent that's becoming available. And you know, as you alluded to, there are markets and industries that are under-resourced right now. So I find that fascinating. One question I had for you, and then we'll bring it back to just kind of your professional kind of managerial and leadership kind of narrative there, is at a macro level, like, you know, what are you seeing in the industry? You know, you said renewables is now 40% of the company's, you know, kind of revenue, or I forget how you had framed that. But the point is, at one point, the assumption is that it was less, and that's a growing and emerging market. But what are kind of the macro trends that you're seeing in the next 2 to 3 years in that space?
Yeah, I mean, so if you just look at like the U.S. power grid, totally. We are based on a centralized system with these big thermal or inertia-based generators. So what I mean by that is like coal plant, think of as like burning hot. That is a thermal generator. Yep. A hydro plant or something that's turning a really big turbine is spinning with a lot of inertia. And that is the way our grid functions. These plants are like designed to be up and running kind of day in and day out. They are very dispatchable. You can turn them on and you can turn them off whenever you please. And we as consumers of energy, as individuals or businesses, we've grown accustomed to that. Like you expect the reliability. When you go to turn on the light switch, the lights are going to come on. Absolutely. 99.999% of the time, right? And as we're seeing old coal plants coming offline, we're seeing some aged infrastructure and assets that are expensive to run, but also, you know, have a huge carbon footprint. Those are coming offline and they're being replaced with wind and solar. The challenge with wind and solar, you will hear often and read in the news, is that they're not dispatchable, right? You can't necessarily turn them on and turn them off, and they're intermittent. Like when the sun's not shining, it's not producing what it would when the sun is up. And so think of like this major transition where we're going from this centralized dispatchable system to now a decentralized intermittent kind of based system. But what we're focused on is making these intermittent resources seem less intermittent and seem more dispatchable. And we're doing that by combining renewable projects all over the country. And making kind of a virtual power plant or making a hybrid power plant. Mm-hmm. And we're also combining energy storage mechanisms, and energy storage can come from, you know, pumped hydro, two dams and two bodies of water and a dam and some pumping makes the oldest form of energy storage. And you can have that for days. And some of the newer forms of energy storage are coming in, lithium ion batteries that are very similar to what's in your electric vehicle, but on a big scale, and they can dispatch, you know, up to 4 hours duration. And so that's what's going on in the market, is like this pivotal shift to make it so that, you know, when everybody's driving electric vehicles, if that's where we get to, that there's the ability to plug your car in and drive to the places that you can. We are creatures of habit and comfort. And today, you know, there's a lot of anxiety around, like, if I buy that car and it only has a 200-mile radius, can I get to where I need to go without having to sacrifice a way of living or a way of traveling? And so we recognize that working in the utility space and working in renewable spaces, that we've got to accommodate these changes and these shifts in how we generate and then how we deliver.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating. I mean, there's as an outsider looking in, you know, one of the frequent conversations that I see that I think is a trend is you know, for decades, maybe up to two, there was like this globalization push, right? Like the world would be better if we kind of globalized. Now there's this, like, at least in the energy sector, like this, we want to be energy independent, right? Instead of dependent, we want to find ways. And so where I say this with in blissful ignorance around, just curious what your perspective is it feels like we kind of need this, I don't know if it's a transition or an augmentation of both, like just to shut down all the fracking and all the power plants is like not the answer, right? But, and for all the reasons that you kind of just mentioned, however, there's so much untapped potential in this other forms of infrastructure that needs to be built, but then it's like kind of the bridge between the two, right? So it feels like we're kind of in this grand decade or decades long transition. If you had to like paint the picture of what, you know, the US energy grid would look like, I don't know, 10, 20 years from now, is the renewables market, what we call renewables, is that going to become the mainstream? And is that going to be 80% of what WoolTech does, minus, you know, some of the other pieces that we're not talking about, but like energy creation and energy storage, will the renewables become just the norm?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous amount of capacity to still bring onto the grid in the next 20 to 30 years, you know, and whether you're looking at Biden's climate agenda, or you're looking at more global and macro scale, you're looking at Paris Accord, we have a long way to go in the next 20 to 30 years to really be making a dent in lowering our carbon emissions. I think in the U.S. market, the next 20 to 30 years, you see a lot more penetration of renewables, but you are spot on. You can't do that alone in a really short period of time. You know, today, wind and solar are the cheapest form of energy generation. So if you were a city or a large utility looking to build a new power plant to feed a 30,000 person community, say, and you sent that out to a competitive RFP or a competitive bid, and you took all forms of energy, chances are, no matter where you are in the state, or where you are at in the country, wind and solar are going to win out as being the cheapest form of energy. And ultimately we all pay for that, right? The user, the ratepayer, the taxpayer.
Yeah.
But the challenge is having them be dispatchable, having the reliability. And so there's so much good momentum in the industry around that shift towards, you know, now that it is the cheapest form of generation, with or without, you know, the help from federal or state level government, it's now really focused around reliability. And it is going to take a transition. You know, it's going to take some years where we still will rely upon natural gas, we'll rely upon hydro. Hydro is still at the tip top of the renewables, you know, spectrum. And then, you know, a lot of folks aren't giving up on the idea that that nuclear has a mainstay and a footprint in kind of our energy portfolio or energy stack here in the U.S. And
yeah,
Reg, you know that from where you're sitting in the state of California there. So,
yeah, I mean, that's been a whole new conversation that I hadn't heard as frequently or as loudly as I have recently, which is obviously this, you're toggling between a push for national energy independence, right? So we're not having to, you know, truck boatloads and barrelfuls from, you know, from the Middle East or whatever. So the appetite to be energy independent, with the fact that, you know, we do need these, bridges or transition fuels, right? So like it opens a conversation up, like which one is more important and how to toggle that, the environmental costs with the political costs, with the independent, you know, the desire to be energy independent. And it opens up the conversation again for nuclear, you know, with fission versus fusion, which it's so fascinating, again, as an outsider, like really trying to understand this. And then you look, coming back to the conversation you were having earlier, like, you know, you look at energy, but then you look at some of the engineering talent. I mean, if our best and brightest coming out of universities found it appealing to go dig deep and spend the next decade of their career like solving those types of problems, I feel like we have the capability to do insanely cool things. You know, we just got to find ways to make it enticing and to continue to keep the talent there, right? When tech pay is paying you hand over fist, you know, dollars, and you're getting all these crazy rewards, but you know, the goal is to go you know, make Twitter better versus, you know, come up with the next energy independent solution or what have you. Like, it's just, it's sucking a lot of the talent in that direction. That's not to badmouth tech. I love it. And I think it's, there's a very bright and necessary future for that. But sometimes it comes at the cost of other, some of these other verticals and markets, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think at least for companies like Alltech who are really focused on kind of that infrastructure and fabric of our society and economy, will always be work on the power side, on the utility side, making sure that there's enough generation and that we can distribute it to end users, right? But if I was to fast forward 15, 20 years, whatever timeline you had mentioned, I think we're going to see a major shift in focus on water. I think that's, you know, there'll be a time when we build out renewables to the point where there will always be operating and maintaining and, you know, repowering those plants. But I think there'll be there needs to be a huge shift towards water conservation, water protection. Yeah. And I think that's the next big play for companies like ours.
That's awesome. I'm fascinated by the whole area. And, I'll definitely continue to pay attention to those trends. So one other question, just, you know, in some of the time that we have remaining here is I'd love to get a better sense of kind of, you know, bringing it back home and making it a bit more personal about your professional experience. Like, you know, in the space that you're in with the companies that you've been exposed to, and, you know, I don't know how many folks you've managed, you know, what the highest and lowest numbers are, but like, what are some of the lessons learned that you look back on, and where do you see kind of opportunities or challenges given your current role? You had talked about kind of talent acquisition as one, just not, you know, really having enough people to even fulfill some of the needs that we have in the industry, but just more personally, you know, where do you see some of your kind of management leadership strengths? And then where do you see kind of needs or opportunities, not only for you personally, but just in the sector?
Yeah, I an area that I've really focused on in the last handful of years is being better balanced, is being, you know, just as a leader, is being better connected to things outside of work. I've grown up watching people work really hard. I had my first job working for the River Store and working for the Wiley family when I was 13 years old. I don't have a work ethic problem. If anything, I'm always looking to try and just be better balanced and make sure that I'm bringing the outside in. And, you know, I'm a student. If like the novice version of the student of just practicing mindfulness and bringing exercise and mindfulness into my everyday world, that has helped me tremendously in my professional endeavors, in my personal endeavors, in my friendships with my closest friends and my children and my wife and my parents. So I think that's, for me, that's my biggest area of, I think, opportunity for continued growth as being a leader. You know, hey, Chad, I find myself, yeah.
I'm so curious. You mentioned how much it's helped when you've been able to bring in that balance, you know, bring some of that exercise and some of the personal passions, if you will, into, you know, in more into your life. How has it helped those relationships that you mentioned?
I'm way more energized when I'm actually in my work. I find that a lot of the work that I do is asynchronous, right? And so like, there's some things that are very much synchronous and I have to do them with the team at that moment. And it's very live. And then there's a lot of things that, you know, way that maybe it's building a 3-year strategy, or maybe it's, you know, doing some future planning around the team or around a particular growth aspect with a client or a portfolio. A lot of that work isn't necessarily synchronous. And so finding ways to stay energized, stay focused, maybe not take things so seriously all the time. And that I think is how it's really helped me. And like I said, I am a student learning. So bring it on.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
Thing. And you were saying, it sounded like you were about to get into something else there, but it's interesting that, like, you know, when asked about like the leadership lessons, it's actually not very much about leadership itself, but more about mindsets and approaches and not taking yourself or situations so seriously. I mean, I think a lot of people get wrapped around the axle and create this narrative that spins them up around this like freneticism and this reactivity and this impulsiveness, and there's never enough time in the day. And that is like day in and day out, so exhausting. And, you know, in our coaching practice with a lot of people, that whatever that is, is where we spend a lot of our time, right? It's just like people's, it's become normal for them, but it shouldn't be normal, right? Just that freneticism and reactivity built in. So when you can, if you're in a snow globe and somebody shakes it up, it's a blizzard and everything's crazy, but if you can get out of that snow globe and get some perspective, you know, it can get as shaken up as you want. You can choose to zoom in or choose to zoom out, but it's like you're autonomous of that moment. That's a huge and very powerful kind of insight.
I find a lot of similarities to, like, our family likes to spend time on the river. And we do as many multi-day river trips as we can fit in as a family. And for those who don't know what that looks like, it's putting in on a river at, say, mile zero and floating down the river and navigating yourself, you know, maybe 5 days, 10 days, 3 days, whatever, and miles down the way. And I often am finding myself in a position of leading my family or leading many families and friends down the river. And you can draw so many similarities to that environment of kind of trip leading a group through the wilderness or through an adventure like that into business. And for me, being better balanced, bringing my work home, bringing my home into my work. And I feel very passionate. I feel very fortunate that I'm passionate about what I'm doing, you know, in this focus on just decarbonization. So I can draw a lot of conclusions to just what we do for fun as pastimes. And, you know, if that's a river trip, you're like, you're making a plan and you're working the plan, and, you know, it might be through running a river or, you know, mapping out campsite to campsite. Sometimes things go wrong and somebody camped in your spot. You gotta make do with plan B or something. And no different than so many situations in leading a business or a team.
You know, the thing that I love most about river trips, or, and I also feel it the same in the ultra distance adventures too, Chad, is it's almost like a forcing, not almost, it is a forcing function for what's most important. Like, it just prioritizes for you exactly what you need to be working on in the order you need to be working on it. You know, like on the river, you're not attached to your phone. You're not getting bombarded by Zoom or text messages or, you know, Slack or whatever the mediums are that contact you. And it's, you're therefore just solely focused on what's important in that moment. And, you know, on a river trip, for example, you may have a plan, just as you mentioned, you know, so you're thinking about how to set yourself and your group up for that, to execute on that plan, but you've got to remain flexible and agile. And, you know, if someone is in your campsite or there's a log across the river or whatever, you know, the million and one variations can be, it's just such an amazing exercise. And, you know, in ultra marathons, I mean, it's not when something goes wrong, it's knowing everything will go wrong probably. And so it's just back to how do you adapt and make the best use of what you have in front of you to continue to move forward to your sort of desired outcome. It's an amazing experience.
Yeah, I loved.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just said I loved listening to the first two podcasts and how you persevere and navigate through those challenges and what you know is going to go wrong is unbelievable. So it was really fun to listen to those, Adam.
No, cool. I'm glad you listened. Thanks, Chad.
I agree. It was interesting to have the first one where it was like preparing going into it, and then like the one afterwards where he was like, everything went out the window. Like, I'm glad I had a plan, but, like, you know, thank God you had shoes and change of clothes and all that stuff. But, like, basically plan A went out the window, like, what, 40 miles in or something? You know, like,
so you're being generous.
Right when the gun went off, you're like, okay, plan A is out the window.
Yeah, but that's business too, right? That's anything that we all deal with. You know, I've had five different small businesses. Chad, you've stood up these departments or sectors in these larger businesses. Regan, you've worked, you know, across many different industries with many different teams. I think we can all probably agree that the one thing that's constant is change, you know, and mm-hmm. and the need to be adaptable to change. And how do you sort of lead through that environment? What does leadership mean? And how do we bring everybody along with us versus, you know, slashing and burning along the way?
It's cheesy and cliche for a reason, right? Like, totally. Just because it's so common. Well, Chad, dude, this has been awesome. I know we're kind of getting close on time here, but I'd love to, you know, what's coming up next for you personally and professionally? Like, maybe like what's a challenge you're putting out there for yourself on either the personal and professional side, and what's coming up for you and the company in 23?
Yeah. So professionally, we are, you know, in the final 4 weeks of closing out what's going to be just a banner year for us. A year that we weren't sure how it was all going to play out, kind of post COVID and yeah. all the talk about potential recession and record high inflation. What's kind of held constant and been our North Star is that, energy consumption is on the rise. The market is really transforming. We are so fortunate to be working for some of the best in the business, building some of the coolest, biggest projects across North America. And with some of the recent legislation that was passed earlier in this year, it creates for the first time ever in this country a pathway for a lot of small businesses, for domestic manufacturing, for clean energy, and so much business and commerce focused around just, you know, supporting climate and decarbonization goals. So couldn't be more excited about that. We're leaning into a lot of new kind of emerging markets and technology around that. So really excited to be sort of growing out of the emerging market space a little bit and feeling like, wow, we're established and we've got this 10-year, 15-year runway to really make a dent and just lower our carbon footprint. On a personal side, it is nuking snow. And I'm so excited for ski season to start. That's one of those ways that I get my yayas out and go ski on the Nordic skis or ski on the downhill skis or go for a tour in the mountains. My kids are 12 and 14, and they are loving to be close to the ski hill. And so just, this will be my second winter in Crested Butte, and, couldn't be more excited for more of that white stuff to be landing on the ground. And, we're pretty pumped.
Dude, that's awesome. Well, you've got some great kids. I haven't seen them in a while, but I'm sure they're just becoming little badasses on the skis, which is cool. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree there. And that's just awesome. I can't thank you enough for your time. And you've got me more excited about like what's coming down the pike in that whole sector. And I want to continue to obviously stay in touch and make sure that you know, anything we can do to help continue to support you and, you know, literally your efforts as an individual, I would love to do that. And if there's anything, you know, I'd love to kind of get your thinking and do some cross-pollinating in our space as well. I think there's a lot of good lessons learned, and I think there's some good insights there. I'm contemplating trying to put together like a little, you know, panel of experts from cross industry to have a discussion about kind of, you know, leadership and overcoming challenge and looking forward to kind of what's coming down the pike in business over the next 2 to 3 years. So that could be a cool opportunity to collaborate on something.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you guys so much for having me. It was great connecting. Love seeing what you're doing with the business, and appreciate you having me on as a guest.
Awesome, man.
Good to see you, Chad.
Yeah, go hit the slopes. Keep us posted. Say hi to everybody. Thanks so much for your time, amigo.
You know it. See you guys.
Bye.